We look around our world at the moment and we see much suffering and affliction. Good people suffering. A policeman, a good man doing his job, killed as he's dragged behind a car driven by teenagers that he's trying to stop. Faithful believers enduring miscarriages, stillborn births, barrenness, the affliction of depression, anxiety, Alzheimer's, broken marriages. Doesn't just affect the wicked, but the good. The young die. Chad Bozeman, the Black Panther, a good man by all accounts, dies young. Why? And we have our nice little theories to try and make sense of it. You know, good people are supposed to be blessed and bad people cursed and punished. But if we're honest, we know that good people do suffer and die and the wicked endure and thrive. Our little theories don't seem to quite fit. You know, is suffering and trial just random chaos, fatalism, que sera, sera, as many believe? Oh, well. Is it dualism? Good versus evil, kind of Star Wars. And evil right now seems to have the upper hand at the moment as we look at our world and COVID-19 and racial tensions. And many begin to ask, where's God in all this? How does he fit? Who is God? What kind of God is he? Is this God worthy of our worship? These are the kind of questions many of us ask, and probably all of us will ask at some point in our life. We'll either do it from the comfort of the armchair in times of not suffering, or we'll do it from the wheelchair as we suffer, or we walk with those who suffer. But they're big questions. And Job is a very long book. 42 chapters to answer these kind of questions, because it's not a simple, neat answer. It's not a quick fix. You can't just take a teaspoon of medicine and everything be okay. And much of the book of Job is written in poetry because poetry does not lend itself to easy answers. It allows us to grapple with emotion and tension in a way that prose can't. We're meant to share in Job's pain and to spend time wrestling with the complexities and the subtleties of suffering and not just rush to the answer of kind of chapter 39 onwards. And there is much, as we read it, we might not grasp or even understand. But can I encourage you to read Job as we go along? We're not going to preach every chapter, sadly. We've just got 10 sermons. One preacher, you probably know, preached 23 years on the book of Job. There's got to be some hard going for his congregation. We're not going to do that. But neither are we just going to do it in just two or three and just kind of skip through the highlights and get to the good stuff, as it were, at the end, if you know the book. We're going to go through it. We're going to try and feel it. But you will benefit if you read along with it, maybe in a version like The Message, to get the nuance and the emotion so you can enter into the perplexities that the book of Job raises. But let's begin this one in chapter 1. And chapter 2, verse 2 sets the scene. And we flip between earth and heaven and earth and heaven and earth. And scene 1 starts with us on earth. The blameless man, verses 1 to 5. And Job comes from us, we're told, we're not sure where that is. He probably lived at the same time as Abraham, or maybe earlier. But Job's not part of the covenant line. He's not part of Abraham's family. And yet, we're given 4 descriptions of him. He was blameless. He was upright. He feared God, and he shunned evil. Blameless doesn't mean sinless. It's not he was perfect, but before God, he has a clear conscience. His sin was dealt with. What you saw was what you got. There was a genuineness about Job and an integrity to him. He wasn't a hypocrite in how he lived. He was a godly man. He wasn't just godly on the outside, but also on the inside. He was a genuine believer. And he was upright. That is, in his dealings with others. He was fair, he was right, he was just. He feared God. That is, he honored God as God. He had a right reverence towards God. There was a humbleness before him. He shunned evil. He lived morally right. He wasn't perfect. He was a sinner, but he was a sinner who was right with God and seeking to live right. He was wealthy and blessed. 7 sons, 3 daughters, much livestock. Verse 3, he was the greatest man among all the people of the East. He was the best of all men, and all recognized it. And he was a family man. He was concerned for his children and their spiritual life. He was even anxious about it. So whenever they had a birthday party, he got up early the next day and offered sacrifices on their behalf in case they had sinned and cursed God in their heart in the midst of their party. It just gives you an insight into the heart of Job. He was a man who was concerned to be right with God, and he knew something of sacrifice. The sacrifice was required for sin. How he knew that, we don't know, but it explains presumably why he was able to be called blameless, because his sin was dealt with. He was forgiven through sacrifice. He was right with God. Now, all of this is important, because what is about to happen to him is not because of some sin or some moral failing or the consequence of some wrong action. In this, he is innocent, he's blameless, he's right with God. To use New Testament language, he's justified before God. So much so that God will call him my servant, verse 8. This is a good man, and he's a believer. And here is Job, and he's a picture of how the ideal life should be. He's right with God, and it brings blessing, healthy and wealthy. It's Psalm 1 kind of picture and language of just blooming and fruitfulness and life as it ought to be. But then we flip to scene 2 in heaven and Satan's challenge, verses 6 to 12. Now, Job's not aware of this court. He's not aware of this discussion. He's not aware of it all the way throughout the book. Presumably, he's only told of it afterwards, but we're kind of given a behind-the-scenes look at the running of the world. So, verse 6, one day, and this is going to be some day for Job. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan, or the Satan, a title meaning adversary, also came with them. And what we have here is a divine counsel. You see it mentioned in Psalm 82, Psalm 89, verse 7, or 1 Kings 22. And it's worth pausing just to understand how God rules his world. There are those who think of this world ruled by many gods, a kind of polytheistic world, lots of little gods with lots of little areas. That's how the world's run. There are those who think of it governed absolutely and simply by one God. What this God says goes, end of story, absolute power, one supernatural being. And this kind of model underlies that often that classic objection to the goodness of God in suffering. Now, how can there be a good God and such suffering in the world? You know, if God is God, all powerful, sovereign, absolute, well, he's not good. And if God is good, well, he's not God because he can't stop suffering. But this kind of model of governance actually is probably best aligned with that of Islam than Christianity. See, the Christian view and what Job 1 portrays is a world that lies under the absolute supremacy and sovereignty of the Creator, who has no rivals, who is unique. There is no God like him. And yet he does not govern the world as it were, the sole supernatural power. He governs the world by the means of and through the agency of a multiplicity of supernatural powers, of which some are evil, the Satan. and begins to explain the presence of evil and its role. And when we read in verse 6 of Satan being present, as part of this divine counsel, he's not kind of gatecrashed it. God calls him in to give a report, verse 7. He's part of this divine counsel. One commentator talks about he functions in much the same way as the opposition party does in British politics. The opposition party's only aim is to take down the government, but by opposing, they also make the government better, or reveal them, or expose them for what they really are. And Satan is here in opposition. But note, he's a supernatural being. He's on the angel level, not God level. He's not God's equal. He's not, as we saw last week, he's not omnipotent, all powerful. He's not omniscient, all knowing. He's not omnipresent, all present. This is not dualism. There's no good versus evil. He is under God's control. That's why, as we saw last week, Martin Luther says he can be called God's Satan. He is supernatural. He is more powerful than a human, but he is not God. He gives an account to God. God asks, "Where have you come from?" i.e., give your report. And Satan has a job to do. And part of that job is, as he stands in opposition, is to expose and to reveal ultimately the glory of God, even though I'm not sure he quite realizes that. And it seems his main work is to roam the world, that's what he says, verse 7, and he roams looking for believers to test whether they are genuine or not, whether their faith is genuine. Hence God's question, verse 8, have you considered my servant Job? Or literally, have you been eyeing my servant Job? And note how highly God thinks of Job, my servant. Often only used of folks like Moses and Elijah. And God then reiterates what we've already seen. There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright. He's a man who fears God and shuns evil. I mean, could you imagine God saying that of you? I mean, Job's pretty special. But Satan's not impressed. Oh, Satan says he only fears you because of what you give him. Because you put a hedge around him, verse 10. If he did not have all that stuff, he wouldn't fear you. And Satan's challenge is, look, Job only worships you, God. Job only obeys you, fears you, seemingly loves you because of what you've given him. Because you protect him. Oh, yes, he's pious. He goes to church. He attends every prayer meeting. Yeah, he's good in that way. But it's because he's discovered that if he honors you, you make him richer and richer, and his children healthy, and his marriage prosperous, and he enjoys fabulous holidays and billions in the bank. Of course, he worships you. He's pious, not because he truly loves you or because you're worthy of worship. It's because you make him prosperous. And of course, Satan's logic is impenetrable, hence his challenge, verse 11. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And here's the nub of the whole book. This is what the book is really about. Yes, it's about an individual who suffers, a believer who suffers incredibly. But the real issue is this. Is God worthy of worship in himself? Is he valuable? Is he to be treasured for who he is, not what he gives, for just himself? Is he to be delighted in and praised and enjoyed and feared because of who he is? The very preciousness of God himself. And there is no other way to publicly establish that other than to allow Satan to harm Job. God's glory is more important than yours or mine or Job's comfort. And in some deep way, that the sufferings of Job are necessary to redound to the glory of God. Satan has evil intentions. God is concerned with his glory and with his people knowing his glory and seeing it. And Satan's role is to oppose, to insist that the genuineness of the believer be tested and proved genuine. It's a hostile and malicious ministry, but it's necessary for the glory of God to be displayed. And there is no other way. And as such, God allows Satan to strike Job. But note, Satan needs God's permission. God is sovereign. God is ruling. God allows the suffering, permits it. Satan can do nothing outside of God's authority. Satan has no power that is not permitted by God. This is not a fatalist world, random chaos. This is all part of God's plan, his divine purposes, even if they cannot fully grasp. And people have tried to get around this over the years, and this idea of God permitting. And Rabbi Kushner wrote a famous book about God and suffering, and in the end, his answer is this. He suggests that, well, God is doing his best, but we can't blame God if he doesn't try and manage to arrange everything in the way he wants. He's doing his best. That doesn't give you much comfort, does it? Others see God as a grand chess master as they seek to uphold, as it were, our free will. And they say, look, most of the time God wins, but every now and then he doesn't. He gets outplayed. He can't know the future. He can't know everything. So he gets outplayed. But the Bible allows no such ideas. God is sovereign. He rules. He permits. As one author puts it, Satan can't touch one hair upon the back of a single camel without the permission of God. Satan does what he is told and no more. And what is at stake here is the glory of God, the value of God. And some might say, well, that's a little egocentric. But the thing is, there is nothing higher in the universe than God's glory, and as such, it is right. It'd be wrong, to say, look, I'm going to give the writer Mark Ventham the prize of being the greatest footballer ever, the Ballon d'Or. We'll reward that to Mark Ventham. That would be weird, wouldn't it? You're kind of, and I would be wanting that praise. No, that would be wrong. I can't play football for Toffee. Just ask my kids. But if you were talking about Messi or Ronaldo, then it's right for them to be spoken of in those terms of being the greatest footballer and getting the greatest awards. It's the same with God's glory. It's right for us to be talking about his greatness and his glory and for him to be seen as that. It's not egocentric if it's right, if it's true, of which it is. That's what's at stake here. That's why permission is given. That's why Satan went out from the presence of God. And we get scene 3, earth, and Job's terrible day, verses 13 to 22. And Satan is wicked. Note what day he picks. He waits until it's the eldest son's birthday to bring the suffering. That day will always be a reminder. And 4 sharp stabs come. First the oxen and the donkeys and the servants with them, destroyed by the Sabaeans. Then the sheep and the servants with them, destroyed through lightning. Then the Chaldeans kill the camels and the servants with them. And then a strong wind collapses the roof and all of Job's sons and daughters. And each event comes one after the other, with barely time for the last messenger to say his word before the next arrives with the next part of bad news. And all is gone. All he had, family, wealth. And he's left with his wife and 4 servants. Terrorism, natural disasters have removed it all. And look at his response. I'm not sure I've been so quick to respond like this. I would like to think I would, but I don't think I would have been. See verse 20. He got up. He tore his robe as a sign of grief, outwardly expressing the kind of the tears of his heart inwardly. He shakes his head, indicating his sorrow, his pain, his grief, and he falls to the ground in worship. He doesn't curse God. All that he has is removed, and he worships. And then he says some of the most profound words ever. They're still used at funerals today. Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I shall depart. I came into this world with nothing. And I'll leave this world with nothing. God gave all I had. And all I had was because of his grace to me. Because of his kindness to me. His generosity he gave. It was all his. And now the Lord has taken it away. And note how Job doesn't blame Satan. He doesn't blame fate or evil. Job knows the Lord's in control, that it's the Lord who is sovereign. It's the Lord who had allowed. It was the Lord who took away. And even how Satan struck at Job, he did so in such a way to kind of make it clear that this is of the Lord's doing. So we're told, you know, fire from God. Lightning killed his sheep. Wind destroyed his family. Satan can't control the weather. God does. Only if God has allowed it could that have happened. Satan can't control the minds of men and to get them to invade unless God had allowed it. And Job, in his grief, in his humility, knows it's the Lord who has taken away. And he says, I don't know why. I don't understand, but I trust, I depend. May the name of the Lord be praised. May he be given all honor, all glory, all power. He's worthy of my praise for who he is. And note verse 22. In all of this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. He didn't cite vengeful anger at God. He didn't start waving his fist. He worshipped. He did not do what Satan said he would do. With that, the scene changes back to heaven, scene 4, a new permission, chapter 2, verses 1 to 6. Council reassembles. Satan presents himself again. The Lord asks where he's been, roaming. Verse 3, have you considered my servant Job? No, again, it's the Lord who puts Job forward. As one author puts it, this is how God treats his friends. But God thinks much of Job. And again, we're told there is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, even though you incited me against him to ruin without reason. When God says Satan incited, it wasn't in the way that we might be incited and end up doing something foolish because we've been so inflamed. God did what God wanted. But it was Satan who brought the challenge, who opposed Job and affronted God's glory. Satan's still not impressed by Job. He wants not just to test him, but destroy him. Destroy this genuine believer, skin for skin. Oh yeah, he's lost everything. But a man will continue to worship you whilst they have their health. Take their health, then he'll curse you. And there's something in that, isn't there? Christopher Ash writes, the point here seems to be that there is a distinction between what a person has and what a person is. What a person is closer to who they are, their heart. It hurts to have what I have taken away, but it does not ultimately hurt me as deeply as when my inner skin is penetrated. Attack my body, attack my soul, that penetrates to who I am. And you often hear people say things like this, don't they? They say, I have my health, so you know what else do I need? And so Satan's onto something here. And once again, shockingly, the Lord permits it. He allows it. And it's shocking in light of all that Job has suffered. I think we would have said, look, enough's enough. He's proven his worth. He's suffered more than any human being in one day. He worships me because he knows I'm worthy to be worshipped. But the Lord disagrees. The glory of God really is more important than yours or mine or Job's comfort. When all Job has is taken, you get an idea of his worship, but that's not enough. when it comes to the glory of God and to the question, is God really valuable, worthy to be treasured for who he is, not just what he gives? And so for a second time, permission is granted. He's in your hands, but you must spare his life. Satan can harm him, afflict him, but he cannot kill him. In part because otherwise we'd never know whether Job worship or curse God. And with that, we return to earth and to the final scene, verse 5, inflicted once more. And note verse 7, it's Satan himself this time who strikes at Job, inflicting him with unbelievable sores, pain from the top of his head to the soles of his feet. And he's a broken man. He sits on the rubbish dump outside the city. And to kind of further add affliction, his wife invites him to curse God. The word curse in verse 9 is actually the word bless. She's being sarcastic. She's kind of saying, keep blessing God and die. Might as well curse him. That's the kind of idea. And Job gently rebukes, speaking like a foolish woman. This isn't how you normally speak. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? And again, even though Satan is the one who afflicted him, Job knows it's ultimately from God, but he doesn't curse him. Just as Satan said he would, no, we're told, in all this, Job did not sin in what he said. Doesn't curse God with his lips. And in many ways, the trial's settled. It's been proven. But as the book continues, heaven is silent until the Lord speaks in chapter 38. And only in chapter 42 will we know for sure that Job is vindicated. And now the wrestle for Job begins in the silence, in the not understanding of the why and having to trust and wonder, had he offended God? And yet he's certain he hasn't, and he's doing it all in the midst of a terrible and life-changing breakdown, confronted, as we'll see, by unhelpful friends. And still he speaks and behaves as a believer. He doesn't get it all right in what he says, but he does not lose faith in God. And he speaks openly and honestly to God in the midst of unbelievable suffering. And as we look at his response, you must not forget his horrific suffering. What happened to him. And the pain that he is so enduring. And it's worth just pausing now at the end, as I close, to ask, well, what about us? How does this affect us? Look, the glory of God is more important than yours or my comfort. And it matters for the glory of God that there should be a man who worships God because he is worthy of worship, to be treasured and valued for who he is and for no other reason. But the book of Job is extreme. Job is extremely more wealthy and healthy than we are, and his suffering is extreme. From the heights he enjoys to the depths he falls are more than any of us will endure. And that's important to remember because he is foreshadowing ultimately Jesus, the one who comes from the greatest heights and greatest splendor and greatest wealth, and he will fall to an even greater depth of suffering than even Job endures. And he is utterly blameless in that he was perfect and he is the innocent sufferer. But we will suffer. And we'll suffer not as a result of our sin, but we'll suffer because of our faith, because we're genuine believers. It's what we've been seeing in 1 Peter. And we saw last week, we have an enemy who's prowling around like a lion, roaming the earth. And just as Satan sifted Peter, so he will seek to sift us, in part to prove the genuineness of our faith. And do you remember what Peter says in 1 Peter 1, 6-7? See how this connects. He says, our faith, we suffer so that our faith may be found to result in praise and glory and honor to the revelation of Jesus Christ. We suffer and tested for the sake of God's glory. On one side, Satan is opposing us and seeking to pull us away from God. On the other, God allows it to prove the genuineness of our faith in him alone, that he is glorified, and to assure us of our faith. So the book of Job is scary. because it presents a reality that is ours, a battle that we're part of. And the question for us as we face affliction and trial and hardship is God worth it? Will we worship him? Will we treasure him for who he is, not just what he gives us? Will we trust his sovereign purposes, clinging to him like Job, even as we're afflicted? And the big difference is that we stand this side of the cross and we have had revealed God's great love and mercy to us in Jesus. We've seen his overwhelming grace to us. We know more of who God is. We have more reasons to treasure him because of Jesus. And we know that Jesus is victorious. We know he's defeated Satan. And we have his spirit to comfort and equip us. We know the end in a way Job did not. We know what's happening. And that because of the cross, there is no condemnation for our sin. We're right with God, certain of that in a way Job wasn't. And part of the wrestle he has is because he doesn't have that certainty. But we do. Jesus has won. The questions will rise and doubt will come. And the book of Job will help us to know how things work, who God is in suffering. So that like Job, we can be confident in his sovereign purposes and worship even as we wrestle and are afflicted.